Welcome to SCOTUScast, a project of the Federalist Society for Law and Public Policy Studies. Our contributors join us from around the country to bring you expert commentary on U.S. Supreme Court cases as they are argued and decisions are issued. The Federalist Society takes no position on particular legal or public policy issues. All expressions of opinion are those of the speaker.
Thank you for joining us for this post-decision episode of SCOTUScast, Regulatory Taking and Contiguous Parcels Edition. I'm your host, Christopher Goffis. On June 23, 2017, the Supreme Court decided Murr v. Wisconsin. In the 1960s, the Murrs purchased two adjacent lots, lots F and E, each over an acre in size, in St. Croix County, Wisconsin. In 1994 and 1995, the parents transferred the parcels to their children, and the two lots were merged, pursuant to St. Croix County's Code of Ordinances, with local rules then barring their separate sale or development. A decade later, the Murrs sought to sell Lot E in order to fund construction work on Lot F, but the St. Croix County Board of Adjustment denied a variance from the ordinance, barring separate sale or development of the lots. The Murrs sued the state and county, claiming that the ordinance affected an uncompensated taking of their property and deprived them of all or practically all of the use of Lot E because the lot cannot be sold or developed as a separate lot. The Circuit Court disagreed and granted summary judgment to the state and county. The Court of Appeals of Wisconsin affirmed, concluding that the Murrs took the properties with constructive knowledge of the resulting restrictions and had not suffered a loss in value of more than 10%. The Wisconsin Supreme Court denied further review. The question before the U.S. Supreme Court was whether, in a regulatory taking case, the parcel as a whole concept as described in Penn Central Transportation Company v. City of New York establishes a rule that two legally distinct but commonly owned contiguous parcels must be combined for takings analysis purposes. By a vote of 5-3, the Supreme Court affirmed the judgment of the Court of Appeals of Wisconsin. In an opinion by Justice Kennedy, the Supreme Court held that the Wisconsin court was correct to analyze Murr's lots as a single unit, and that no compensable taking had occurred. Justice Kennedy's majority opinion was joined by Justices Ginsburg, Breyer, Sotomayor, and Kagan. Chief Justice Roberts filed a dissenting opinion, in which Justices Thomas and Alito joined. Justice Thomas filed a dissenting opinion. Justice Gorsuch took no part in the consideration or decision of this case. And now, to discuss the case, we have James S. Berman, who is Vice President of Litigation for the Pacific Legal Foundation.
This case is all about how to determine what property one is talking about when a landowner claims property has been taken by regulation. You can look at it in these terms. If all you own is 1 acre of property and that property is designated entirely to be wetland, open space, endangered species habitat, and you can't use that property at all, that 1 acre at all, then there's no question that your property has been taken. But what if you own 10 acres of property around that? The other 9 acres are developable. You still can't use this 1 acre. Have you had anything taken? Is the law the more you own, the more government can take? And that's the issue that was before the court in Murr versus Wisconsin, a decision that I think is so unworkable that it's going to fail the test of time. So let's go into a little bit of the history of the case first. The Murr family, parents, they were middle-class people. They owned a plumbing company in Wisconsin. They bought this beautiful lot at 1.25 acres fronting Lake St. Clair in 1960. They built a small 950-square-foot cabin on that property, and they liked it so much they decided as an investment to buy the lot next door. Not with a plan to do anything with it at any time, but just to have it there as the family, sort of the treasure of the money in the bank, if you will, because they knew how wonderful this area was. So they owned these two lots, and one was owned separately by the husband and wife. One was owned by their plumbing company. And things moved along. In 1975, there were land use regulations put in place. These land use regulations impose setbacks for water frontage, for steep slopes, etc. And as a result of these setbacks, the buildable area on these 1.25 acre lots was now less than 0.5 acre. And as such, they were non-conforming lots. Nobody thought too much of that. In 1994 and 1995, the parents had become quite elderly and transferred the two lots respectively to the children. So you have one lot fronting the lake with a cabin on it, one lot that is not used at all, has nothing on it, called the investment lot by the family. And in 1995, the children own these lots in their own name. As a unified family, they own the property. In 2004, they began exploring the possibility of selling the second lot. They frankly needed the money to fix up the cabin on the first lot. It was now getting quite old, and it had some problems with some water rising and a little bit of flooding from time to time, and they thought it's really time to put some real money into fixing this thing up. And they were told at that time that, no, they can't sell the second lot. Why? Because it is substandard. And the substandard lot can't be sold. Now, there was a grandfather clause that if anybody else had owned this second lot, that anybody else could have developed it or sold it. But because the MERS owned this lot and they owned the lot next door, the agency said, no, you cannot sell or develop your second lot because you own the one next door. They went for a variance at the Zoning Board of Appeals. It was denied. They brought a taking case in Wisconsin state courts, arguing that, look, we have this lot that has no use and value left to it. It is a taking. But the court disagreed. The court said that there is a well-established rule that contiguous property under common ownership is considered as a whole, regardless of the number of parcels contained therein. In other words, the more you own, the more government can steal. And this was a rather extraordinary rule saying in all cases that if you have contiguous lots for terms of zoning, they have to be considered as one. So if the MERS owned one lot or 10 lots, they'd all be considered together as one. The MERS at that point came to us and Pacific Legal Foundation. After they were denied by the Wisconsin Supreme Court, they came to us and we asked the Supreme Court to take the case. The court took the case. It took quite a long time for the court to get around to holding oral argument after the death of Justice Scalia. And we think it was because it was a very close opinion and the Justice Roberts was waiting for another member of the court. As it turned out, it just took so long that we had oral argument before Justice Gorsuch came on, and Justice Gorsuch was not part of this case. But the court really confused, I think, the issues of contiguous parcels substantially in its decision. Now, I should mention that today, June 28th, is the 25th anniversary of Lucas, the Lucas versus South Carolina Coastal Council case. And that looms large in this case because there the court said that the first thing you have to look when you're deciding whether or not you have a taking claim is what is the nature of the property interest? What are the background principles of the property? And so Lucas teaches the wise practitioner that in order to win any taking case, whether you're going to bring a total wipeout under the Lucas rule or a Penn Central balancing test or whatever, you first have to understand what the property is in order to understand what has been taken. And there is a footnote in Lucas saying, well, you know, if you have more than one lot, it might not be an all or nothing. You have to look at what the relevant parcel is. Penn Central says you look at the relevant parcel. Penn Central is a case, of course, involving the New York City Railroad Terminal that they wanted to build a skyscraper on top, and the court would not look at the air rights separately from the rest of the real estate. And so the question has come up. For a situation like the MERS, what has been taken? Do you look at the one lot, the investment lot, where there's no use and value, or do you combine that with the adjacent lot, or as Wisconsin court said, the adjacent lots if they own more than that? And then you look at the impact, the economic impact of the regulation. If all you look at is the one investment lot, then clearly there's been a total wipeout. There's been a taking, and it's obvious, like my example earlier of the person who owns 1 acre of wetland and nothing else. But now that the MERS are told to consider both lots together in a takings analysis, They have some use of the cabin. They have a 950 square foot cabin on one of the lots. They could tear that cabin down and build a bigger house, a house perhaps that straddles both the investment lot and the original cabin lot. So there the court said that there is no taking. But the question is, what about this individual lot? This individual lot was separately deeded, separately taxed for years and years, and it was really considered to be separate under Wisconsin law. There is never any formal merger. And so the court began well enough in this opinion of the Supreme Court in Murr and opinion by Kennedy, talking nice talk about property rights. Kennedy says, for example, property rights are necessary to preserve freedom, for property ownership empowers persons to shape and plan their own destiny in a world where governments are always eager to do so for them. That's typical Kennedy-esque nice language. Everyone, I think that just sounds wonderful. But then the very next sentence says, the other persisting interest is the government's well-established power to adjust rights for the public good. Is my response to that. So the question, Kennedy begins saying whether there are reasonable expectations about property ownership would lead a landowner to anticipate that his holdings would be treated as one parcel or instead as separate tracts. The inquiry, he says, is objective, and the reasonable expectations at issue derive from background customs and the whole of our legal tradition. More of this Kennedy, rather vague but high-sounding language. But if you unpack that sentence, he talks about reasonable expectations as this, it's an objective standard. But it's really subjective. Is my expectation objective or subjective? And if you're talking about reasonable expectations as defining what the property is in and of itself in the first instance, well, I expect I own 2, 3, 4, 5 parcels, but do I expect them to be treated as one or treated as separate tracts? It becomes very difficult. So Kennedy put it into a 3-part test. And the first part began innocently enough. He says substantial weight is given to the treatment of the land, in particular, how it is bounded or divided under state or local law. That's exactly what we were arguing. Our argument was that the lot lines and the deeds that are recorded in the county courthouse should create a presumption of separate parcels because that's the way they are considered under the law. But then Kennedy moves on. He says, we have to have a reasonable expectation of an acquirer of land must acknowledge that the legitimate restriction affecting his or her subsequent use or dispensation of the property. In other words, you buy property knowing the government can come in later and tell you that you can't use it, and therefore you have no expectation to be able to use it. This is very circular reasoning. And then he continues, a reasonable restriction that predates a landowner's acquisition can be one of the objective factors that landowners would reasonably consider in forming fair expectations about the property. And I'm not exactly sure what that means, a reasonable restriction that predates a landowner's acquisition, so what's reasonable, what's not, can be an objective factor that most landowners would reasonably consider. I would think if I bought a separate lot for investment purposes, that if it was a buildable lot, I could develop that, and I wouldn't necessarily anticipate the government coming in later and telling me not to. Am I being reasonable or unreasonable? Anyway, let's move to the second factor that Kennedy raises. And the second factor is the physical characteristics of the landowner's property. He talks about the physical relationship of any distinguishable tract, the parcel's topography, and the surrounding human and ecological environment is relevant to determining whether or not this is a separate parcel. Pray tell, what is the surrounding human and ecological environment supposed to mean other than full employment for land use attorneys for a century to come? Everybody's going to be arguing, well, the physical relationship of distinguishable tracts concerns the human environment or the ecological environment. Now, I frankly don't know what that means. And then he continues that in particular, it may be relevant that the property is located in an area that's subject to or likely to become subject to environmental or other regulation. And here, Kennedy is citing his concurring opinion in Lucas. Lucas is a case where Justice Scalia and the majority of the court found South Carolina had taken David Lucas's property because they destroyed all use and value of that property. But Kennedy had a concurrence that would have added a number of wishy-washy factors to the Lucas opinion. It was only a concurrence and it didn't carry the day, but you can see Kennedy reaching back from his concurrence 25 years ago and sticking that into the Murr decision. So he talks about what's likely to become or subject to other regulation. Does that mean that if you buy nice property in a nice area, you should anticipate increasing government regulation? He continues with, I think, a very chilling quote for anybody who owns property in coastal areas. He says, quote, "Coastal property may present such unique concerns for a fragile land system that the state can go further in regulating its development and use than the common law of nuisance might otherwise permit." Lucas, of course, was coastal property. Lucas was quite clear that government could not impose regulations beyond those that are part of the background principles of nuisance law. But here, Kennedy is saying coastal property is unique. Government can regulate it without takings liability. I think that's what he's saying. If it is a coastal area, that nuisance law wouldn't allow this restriction, but if it's a good idea because coastal property will do that. The third factor Kennedy talks about, he says courts should assess the value of the property under the challenge regulation with special attention to the effect of burdened land on the value of other holdings. In other words, in this particular case, the investment lot did make the cabin lot more valuable because the investment lot gave open space to the cabin lot and therefore added some value to it, and that sort of thing should be considered. So, in other words, Kennedy is talking about this sort of this gestalt of everything that is thrown into this basket together, and we'll just talk about it and argue it until the lawyers can go home late in the evening sometime, I suppose. Now, the court did recognize that the state of Wisconsin was completely ignoring that lot lines, and they should have some, you know, some value to here. But I think that by and large, the standards that Kennedy has put into considering what the property is in the first place, investment-backed expectations, that sort of thing traditionally was considered after we defined what the lot was. So first step, as I said at the outset, is you define what the property is. The second step is to consider whether that property has been taken. And in that second step, under Penn Central, we had considered such things as investment-backed expectations, the value of the regulation, the character of the regulation, so on and so forth. But now Kennedy is saying that in the first step of defining what the property is, you get to consider all these other factors, and then you're going to consider them again in the second step. So this is a multi-factor standard on steroids. Kennedy talks about the treatment of property under state and local law, indicates petitioner's property should be treated as one only because of voluntary conduct in bringing the lots under common ownership. That is because the parents gave both lots to the children voluntarily, and the children didn't realize that there was this sort of Damocles hanging over them by accepting both lots. At oral argument, Justice Ginsburg at one point said, well, you know, they should have known. They should have said, Mom and Dad, we don't want that second lot. Give it to somebody else. I mean, seriously. The parents were old. They didn't realize that giving both lots to the children would create this problem, so they should have seen it coming. Kennedy says petitioners could have anticipated public regulation might affect their enjoyment of their property. So it's not only what regulations are in place today, but you should have seen it coming. Now, Justice Roberts had a dissent, and it was a good dissent in some ways, but a very troubling dissent in other ways. So let me give a quote and get what I'm talking about. "This bottom line conclusion does not trouble me. The majority presents a fair case that the Murrs can still make good use of both lots, and that the ordinance is a commonplace tool to preserve scenic areas for the benefit of landowners and the public alike." And then Roberts gets into saying that, you know, this is really putting the cart before the horse. The result is that the government's regulatory interests will come into play not once, but twice. first when identifying the relevant parcel, and again when determining the regulation has placed too great a public burden on that property. So, in other words, Roberts isn't terribly upset about the result here. He thinks, yeah, the MERS have lost the ability to use this property alone and separately, but they still get something out of it because their other lot is worth more now and they can combine them and build a big house on them, I suppose. And there is one other dissent by Justice Thomas. Justice Thomas said, you know, our regulatory takings doctrine is not very well founded in the law. There's been a lot of debate of whether it's in the takings clause. Maybe it should be a due process, maybe privileges and immunities. He cites a law review article to that extent. I'm not quite sure. I think there's plenty of good scholarship that the court apparently is not aware of that talks about property rights and first principles, and that the regulatory takings doctrine really is not something that came up in whole cloth with Justice Holmes, and that it was really part and parcel of the way that this nation has viewed property for a long time, for centuries now, since the founding. But that scholarship is a little lost, so we have Thomas asking for us to look again at first principles. It might not hurt in future briefing to this and other courts to remind the court that there are strong doctrinal bases for the regulatory takings doctrine, but this is not the case to do it in.
Thank you for listening to this episode of SCOTUSCast. SCOTUSCast is a project of the Federalist Society, a not-for-profit educational organization of conservative and libertarian law students, law professors, and lawyers, founded upon the principles that the state exists to preserve freedom, that the separation of governmental powers is central to our Constitution, and that it is emphatically the province and duty of the judiciary to say what the law is, not what it should be. Don't forget to subscribe to our podcast series, including SCOTUSCast and Practice Group Podcasts, on iTunes or Google Play. For an archive of past podcasts, as well as audio and video of past Federalist Society events, please visit our website at fedsoc.org/multimedia. That's fedsoc.org/multimedia.
This has been a FedSoc audio production.